Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, and general awesomeness. My name is Chris Albin, and this week I am solo hosting once again, so welcome. So a few weeks ago, I did another solo episode called Learning Machine Learning, where I talked about how I would recommend someone go about learning data science and machine learning. And people apparently liked it. So on Twitter, I asked, you know, what would people like to see in a follow-up episode? And Andrew Thirio, who's the chief data officer of the city of Boston and a friend of the show, suggested a discussion of everything that has to do with doing data science that you wouldn't learn in a boot camp or grad school or MOOC or Kaggle or Kaggle or whatever, stuff like that, which is a great idea for a show. So this episode is going to be about, you know, probably my personal survey for all the things that a data scientist should learn, but don't really get talked about that much because it's not directly data science. And just like last time, a quick disclaimer, this is my advice, not all-knowing truth, like not truth with a big T. The things that I'm going to talk about are the things that I run into and my angle on it and the stuff that I had to learn and am learning and that kind of stuff. So someone might come in with a different background and think to themselves, like, this advice is bullshit. And in that case, it actually generally might be right and it's not really for them, but this is mine, so take it or leave it. But before anything else, a word from our sponsor. The world needs more data superheroes, and Vera's parent company, Rapid Insight, is on a mission to empower generations with superhuman abilities to work with data as efficiently and productively as possible, and even have some fun in the process. With Vera, you can still harness your R skills, but also take advantage of its visual tools to do things even quicker. Plus, Vera allows you to collaborate with non-coders to get work done faster by a whole team. You can connect to any data source to blend and transform for analysis, SQL, Oracle, Access, Hadoop, Salesforce, Text, Teradata, Vertica, Amazon Redshift, you name it. And you can do it quickly and easily with a visual drag and drop interface. Vera is currently rated the number one advanced analytics solution by a number of reviews and total ratings on Gartner's Peer Insight website. Share your data superhero story and you can get an official data superhero starting kit at getvera.com. Go be a data superhero. Okay, so I think there's three big things that you won't learn in a MOOC or grad school and that kind of stuff. And these are the three big things that I didn't learn getting my PhD. So this is sort of directly related. The first is software engineering, actual software engineering. So, you know, when you're in grad school or you're doing a MOOC or something like that, you're really focused on sort of the statistical machine learning parts of it. But a lot of what you're doing, or almost entirely of what you're doing, is writing scripts. Just one or two files that can be very long, but you just, you know, run them from the start and they work their way through and then they spit out some outcome at the end. That is okay, right? if you're doing that kind of analysis. That's what I wrote in grad school, just a lot of scripts. And, you know, that's okay, but that's not going to work in a sort of a real environment where you're working with other people, because a lot of times as a data scientist, your job isn't going to be to write one-off scripts. It's going to be to help build applications with other developers. And that's the part that I you know, kind of want to get in people's heads, that like is a super common discussion out there, is that there are a lot of people who have a background in statistics and machine learning and AI and that kind of stuff. But what really matters is that those people can work as part of a software development team or part of an IT team or part of a hardware team, and can contribute in a real way to what they're doing. And often how that works out is software engineering, not writing scripts, but thinking about it in terms of apps, in terms of systems, in terms of like applications that are running, and how can we do that? So here's some parts that I had to work through. First, functional and object-oriented programming paradigms. And you know, you can look these up on your own. These are just sort of approaches to writing code that have advantages and sort of, you know, like, I guess if they would be like food, it would be like a style of food and people are really, really into certain styles of food. But they are important because people will expect you to, you know, say they are a functional programming shop. They'll expect you to come in and be like, okay, cool. You know the basics of it. Like, you can go and work on it. And it doesn't mean you need to be an expert in it and know all the nuances of it. But at least you should be able to walk in and understand like how they're going about thinking about things. For example, with functional programming, as the name implies, the basis of how code in the system works is through functions, and functions are everything, and functions are passed to other functions, and functions don't create variables outside of functions, and all that kind of stuff. So it's like a way of thinking about how to write code. The second one is Git. Git is version control. So if I end up, you know, making a change to the file, I can go back and reverse that change. But kind of more importantly, it means that a lot of developers can work simultaneously on a piece of code. So with something like GitHub, which is a company who built a product based on Git, it means that I can say, you know, we have the master, you know, the master branch that has the fully functional code, and then I can branch off my own side part of the software and change something about it and then merge it back into the main part, and everyone's kind of doing that loop or a similar loop. And understanding how that works is both important working in a software development space, but it's also big just for your own resume, because you're going to want to put code on GitHub so people can see that you're actually doing, you know, like doing work for your resume and working on open source projects if you're doing something like that. And so it's kind of nice to be able to work with that. And it's one of those things where most developers, including myself, know some commands really well, and then there's this deep, deep range of commands for really complicated stuff that most of us don't get into. So you don't need to like be an expert in this, but you should be able to, like, you know, branch something out and pull data down and push data up and that kind of stuff. I guess, you know, the next one is the command line, which was probably related to Git, but that's okay. So a lot of times you're not going to be working with a graphical interface, right? You're not going to be clicking. What you're going to do is do things at scale, or do things at fast, or do things on what's called a headless machine, which means it doesn't have a screen or anything. In cases like that, you're going to want to be able to work in the Unix or Linux command line. And, you know, that means that you can change files and, you know, like change the path to Python and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, to give an example of how this comes up, I wrote a script over the weekend to convert IPython notebooks, like a few hundred IPython notebooks, into PDF. But there's some kind of annoying feature / bug in Jupyter where if you actually run the command to convert IPython notebooks into PDFs, it converts it into a LaTeX file in some temporary directory and then converts it to the PDF. But that means that you have to run the command in the actual folder. And my IPython notebooks were in a lot of really deep folders. So I had to write a command line, like a script, like a bash command line script, to go through and sort of wander through these different folders and say, okay, if the folder has this in the first line, go here, run this command, then go back out one level, and then move to the next one, and then go back in it, and then run the command and go out and go, you know, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is sort of, you know, like, I'm not doing advanced stuff, but it is really useful to be able to control your machine in a really specific way. And it becomes really useful when we go to the next one. So the next one is cloud computing, specifically Amazon Web Servers and sort of Linux boxes. So you have a computer on your desktop, but when you start to want to do more advanced things or thinking about things in terms of applications, you don't have an application, you know, you don't have some commercial application that's running on your laptop because you close your laptop and then the application doesn't work. What you'll have is you'll have machines in the cloud, basically permanently connected to the internet, and typically they're not real actual computers, they're sort of real actual computers that you sort of are broken up where you can rent out like a 1/10 of them or something like that for a few hours, or permanently, I guess. And you know, with that's what Amazon Web Services is a bunch of tools around having all of their, you know, Amazon has a huge amount of these servers in the cloud, and you can sort of rent them out for various tasks. And there's lots of things you can do this. For example, I just got access to some Amazon machines that have really good graphical processing units, which are important for doing deep learning. And, you know, that means that, like, I'm never going to see the machine. I'm just going to connect to it, and it's going to basically be a command line for the machine. And then I'm going to need to set it up. And these are all Linux boxes. So you need to figure out, okay, well, how do I do stuff with Linux? And, like, how does Linux work? And, you know, what are the commands for doing stuff? How do I, you know, set permissions and et cetera, make directories and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's a big one. And I actually, that was probably one of the funnest ones for me to learn, because it is so cool to have a machine that's controlled somewhere else that runs 24/7. And with, you know, with Amazon, it's either, if you get a really cheap machine, I think it's like free for a whole year or something crazy like that. And so you just have it, like, I just have a machine right now that's just permanently like online. And then you can do really cool stuff like a Twitter bot. Well, you don't want a Twitter bot to run on your laptop. You want to run on the machine. So I just have a Twitter bot that's like super simple, but it runs on this essentially free machine from Amazon. And it's fun because you start to be able to build stuff really, you know, actual things, it feels like. And related to that is the next one, which is, you know, managing development environments. So, okay. If you want to set up something, say, you know, set up your computer, you go install Anaconda or whatever, you like, you know, you install Python, and then you install sort of, you know, NumPy, or you install R and all that stuff, and then you get, it's kind of set up and then you run. A lot of times what you want to do in a real professional environment is actually have that kind of setup and managing that all be done through code itself. So there's a lot of tools out there that make it so, say, for example, I could spin up a brand new instance, so a brand new virtual computer on Amazon, and then run one command, and it sets everything up. So it installs Jupyter for me, and installs NumPy, and you know, pandas, and all that kind of stuff, and it gets it all set up for me all in one go with the perfect right of version numbers, and everything tested, and everything cool. And then I can work with it. And then I work with it for a few hours. And then when I'm done, I delete that instance of the computer. So I like stop having that control over that computer. And then next week I load it up again, and I, you know, can build it out again. That becomes really important when there's lots of devs working on the same piece of software, because that piece of software is actually going to be run on, say, the development environment that I'm working on a feature on. And another developer is working on another feature, so they have an instance of that piece of code running there too. And our two systems have to be as if they are exactly the same, because even if I have a slightly different version number of, say, pandas, nothing will go wrong until it totally breaks, and then we have to go figure out why it's totally broken. And it's because I was, you know, using whatever. I was using 16 and they were using 17, and something changed in how the system worked, or how pandas versioning worked. The next is testing and unit testing. Testing is a big part of one. Testing is a big part of software development, in that it is pieces of code that make sure other pieces of code work. So, you know, like one of the sort of simplest examples is unit testing, which takes some unit of code, say, for example, just one function, and says, hey, if I put in, 24, and I get out 48, awesome, cool, test passed. But if I put in 42 and it comes out with an error, okay, the test didn't work. Something's wrong in there, like it can't accept 42 for some reason. And unit tests are just a huge, like a bunch of code that does that to different parts of the system, and then also tests if the system, you know, integrates with another system, and if a user clicks a button, if it does the right thing. All that kind of stuff is like the world of software testing. And there's a joke that, you know, the big thing that data scientists don't have is they have no idea what a unit test is, because why would you ever write a unit test in grad school? You just sort of, you just write your own script, and then if it doesn't work, you like, you know, change your script and keep it going. So that kind of stuff, unit testing is a big deal. And test-driven development, which is when you write the tests first and then run it, and all the tests obviously fail because you don't have any code. You just have a bunch of code for testing, but you don't have any actual code to build the software. and then you work your way through and write code that passes the test. So if you have some kind of, you know, machine learning pre-processing pipeline, and you say, okay, well, what I want this system to do is first load the data. So I write a test that sees that would pass if I loaded the data correctly. And then I want to standardize all the features. So you write a test that makes sure that all the features are standardized. And then say I want to run, I want to run some kind of dimensionality reduction. And so I write a test that would show if that dimensionality reduction worked. And then I run it, and all the tests obviously fail because there's no that the pipeline doesn't exist yet. Only the test for the pipeline exists. And then I go back and I write the code that passes the test. And so in this simple example, it doesn't really seem that important. But when you have a big, big, big complicated system, you can imagine, you know, a huge scoreboard of a bunch of tests, like hundreds of tests, and all the developers are just, they just can focus on writing code that passes that individual test and be confident that if it passes that test, it'll work with the whole system, which can make life a lot easier. The next one is the familiarity with full stack. So in software, stack is sort of like a loose term for, you know, say all the way down to the Linux server and all the way up to like some JavaScript chart that you get to click on and everything in between. And there are developers who are full stack developers as like a thing. You're probably not going to be that, and I don't suggest you become that, although I guess it'd be cool. But there is this thing about being familiar with the whole range and not an expert in the whole range, right? Not some unicorn who knows everything. But it's really cool to be able to build a website and say build a dashboard and have, you know, use JavaScript to create these interactive visualizations that, you know, a client or your boss can really enjoy. And that's cool, right? Totally awesome. But that means you're going to have to go outside of data science to, you know, actually go and learn some JavaScript and visualization stuff. And it's also cool to go back down the other way, right? And have some kind of thing where you're setting up some GPU or running some C code because it's faster or something like that. That's cool. Like that's a nice toolkit to have, even if you're not great at it, just to be sort of familiar with it and able to take advantage of it if you wanted, or at least being able to interact with someone who does it. And the next thing are tools that make it possible to scale up the amount of data that you're working with, or scale the speed at which you process stuff. And this can be incredibly important to have as a skill set, because in the real world, the data sets that you deal with are often huge. Like, they're not one text log file, which might be sort of something that I would use in a tutorial, but they're a million text files. And so how do you take a million text files, each with, say, like row log data, and actually work with that? So you have to load a million text files in, and that's going to be too big with memory. So maybe you have to do it in batches, or maybe you have to spread it across lots of computers and then aggregate the results and all that kind of stuff. That's a skill set in itself that has a lot of tools, like Hadoop, which I don't really recommend, something like Spark, which I definitely recommend, for working with that kind of stuff. And that's a really popular skill for companies to want, because of course they're working with a lot of data often, and they want people who are able to work with it. And along those lines, you should be able to work with databases. There's a lot of different type of databases. Database architecture is a huge topic into itself, and I obviously don't recommend you become an expert in that, although it'd be cool. You should be able to work with it, because not every single thing is a CSV file or a MySQL database. There's Mongo, there's Cassandra, there's a bunch of other databases out there, and they all have different features. Like, some are really good at column operations, like running some, you know, aggregating a column, so the average of, say, a single feature, while the other ones are really good at things like row operations, like adding a new row to the bottom of something. And that can kind of, you know, knowing that stuff, and even if you're not an expert in it, just like knowing that it exists and being able to work with it is, again, useful. Just familiarity, not expertise. The next one is being able to, you know, work with a team, like knowing things about Scrum and Agile and Lean and that kind of stuff, which are just a bunch of different philosophies around how software should be made, like literally the act of people working together to make software. So, okay, well, do we you know, like, do we take a big project and then we break it up into different parts, and how big are those parts, and how do we work together, and how do we see which parts I do versus which your parts do, and that kind of stuff. And there's a bunch of just, get, you know, tutorials online that sort of overview it. And again, not, don't be an expert. Just if you walk in the door and someone says, hey, we have a scrum meeting in 10 minutes, you go, cool, I know what that is. I've never been to one before, but I know what that is. So I'll just go in and be able to, like, at least fake it that I am comfortable with it. Next big set, you know, outside of software engineering is sort of project management and working with it, working inside an organization. So one of the big things for me leaving academia was when I was getting my PhD, I got to do a lot of stuff alone by myself, because the nature of political science research is that you projects are rarely big enough that you have a big team of people. Normally you have you and one other co-author or that kind of stuff. And so it was kind of, you know, I got to sit by myself and work for a while, and that's great. That's totally awesome. But in the real world, you're going to be working for organizations that have 10 people or 30 people or 50 people or 100 people or 10,000 people. And being able to operate in that environment is a very useful set of skills to have. And also not something that it's really, there's a book for. Like, there's no great learning path for that kind of stuff other than being observant. So when I first started working, I really didn't, you know, like there was things I liked and didn't like, and I didn't really actively think about that. You know, like I didn't sit back and say, okay, why did I not like this? Why did I not do that? And then when I started to do more project management work, I actually realized that whole time I should have been evaluating and being like, why did that project really suck for me? Like, as someone who was working on it, or why did it suck for the customer or the client or whatever? Like, where did someone else mess up, or where did I mess up? And that kind of stuff, and just being conscious about that. So, you know, like the big things for me are probably the biggest thing is being able to convert vague goals into, you know, very specific deliverables. So rarely you're going to have a situation where someone comes to you and says, hey, what I need is you to take this very specific piece of data twice a day and give me the P score of, this is just a simple example, of you, you know, running it and making sure that P score is exported into a text file and in this certain directory. That would be awesome if that happened. That never really seemed to happen. What instead happens is someone comes to you and says, hey, we want to know more about how our customers are behaving. Go. And you have to figure out what that is, right? Like, you have to figure out how do you go about doing that. And there's a lot, when you get into the specifics, there's a lot of questions about it. And being able to convert that sort of vague goal, that vague ask of them, into, well, what is it? Do you want it every day? Do you want it in a dashboard? Do you want it in an email? Like, how do you want it delivered? How do you want me to make it? Do you want me to integrate it into a system? Should I run it on my laptop? Should I run it on a server? Are you running the servers? Am I running the all that kind of stuff. And turning that into something, you know, turn that vague goal into something that you can work with is important. And the big one is that I sort of work on a lot is deliverables. So, like, breaking it down into, like, I will give you X, Y, Z formatted like K. And they go, okay, cool. And then later on, what will probably happen is they go, actually, let's do it this way and let's do it that way. And they go, okay, cool. So instead of K, we'll do it Z. Like, just making it very concrete. So you don't have to think about how the whole organization is strategizing about this stuff. All you need to think about is, I need to build X, Y, and Z structured as K or formatted as K. That's what you work on. And this goes right into the next one, which is the idea of, you know, managing up and managing down. So managing up is, you know, well, it's a term that people use when sort of how to work with your manager, right? And managing down is how to, like, work with the people who are your direct reports. And, you know, the big thing for me that I have gotten a lot better at recently, just as an aside, is over-communicating and managing expectations. So I have a natural tendency, because I'm an introvert and because I, you know, really thrived in academia, that, like, I just want to, you know, you tell me what to do, and then I don't talk to you for 4 months, and then I come back, and I've done 4 months of work, and here you go. And that is the wrong way of doing it. That is personally appealing to me, but that that just never seems to work out. Like, the people think that you haven't been working, or like they don't understand why you've made some decisions along the way and that kind of stuff. And instead, when I started, you know, working in organizations, is the idea of really over communicating, like just be constantly barraging people with information, because even if you don't think that piece of information is important, like say the update of what you've done in the last 3 days, it's important just to keep them, you know, like show them that you're doing stuff, show them how you're making decisions, telling them things that if they change their mind, say they're your manager and they want to do something else, like you could say, okay, well, you know, like this is what I have been doing and let me do it this other way, rather than say like just leaving for 4 months then coming back. That's important. Over communicate as much as humanly possible. And of course, managing expectations, this one's super simple, but it is kind of important. When I started, I would try to impress people with my predictions of how good it would be or how long it would take or that kind of stuff. I don't do that anymore. I try to under-promise and over-deliver. So if I think I'm going to deliver, you know, 5 units of value, just some arbitrary unit of value, I'll say that I can do 2.5 and I'll try to get 7. Like, instead of what I was doing before, which was like asking them, or, you know, saying I could give them 7 and then I would only do 5. And the reason for this is that, you know, if you promise 7 and you make 7, they're okay with it because you've done exactly what you said. But if you promise 7 and give 5, well, then they think that, you know, it sucks because, yeah, you promised them, you overpromised them. But if you promise them 2 and you give them 5, awesome. Or if you promise them 2 and give them 2, well, they're still okay with that because that's all you said that you could give them. So like this kind of idea of like don't impress people with what you promise you can do. Just impress them with what you actually deliver. And your life working on a team will be incredibly important. So the last one, and a big one, I think, for me recently, is having, you know, how do you put this? Active continuous learning. So I don't know a data scientist who isn't actively learning a new skill. I just don't. I like looking around at all the people, I see them constantly reading tutorials or watching a lecture or, you know, reading a book or something like that. And it's just the nature of this field that you're constantly working on learning something new and you like doing that. And if you don't like doing that, you know, I mean, I'm sure this feels fine for you, but it is one of those things where it's a lot easier if you're sort of constantly getting better and constantly working on the next thing. And this is the part of the, you know, this is the part of the field that I really enjoy, because the great thing about getting a PhD was having an infinite amount of things to learn and having time to go and learn them. That is what this field is to me, where there are a ton of things, even some, you know, some specifics of all the things I just mentioned that I am actively trying to get better at. Literally, I have a Google document where I have a list of skills and tools and that I want to learn, and I rank them all between 1 and 3. So 1 is like, you know, I guess 0 would be not knowing at all. 1 is sort of just a little bit familiar, and 3 is that I could teach it. And I can, you know, go through that list every few months and update it and focus on what I want to learn next. And the idea is to just be conscious about it, right? Like to be consciously trying to do it. You'll gain stuff on the job as you work, of course, but there are things that you won't learn on the job because, say, the job uses, you know, say your job uses a certain technology set, like, say, Microsoft products, but you know, like it's really useful to learn a lot of Linux stuff. So you should go and try to learn that on your own and be conscious about it and be active about it. And like, don't just think that you're going to osmosis everything that you need, you know, try to make it better for yourself and learn these new things. Want to learn about computer vision? Well, go and learn about computer vision. And that's not to say that you have to, you know, have 500 side projects and you have to be, you know, super active in the open source space or that kind of stuff. But I hope, and if you're listening to this podcast, it's probably true that you are interested in that continual learning, interested in the fact that, at the end of the week, you know more and are better and are more knowledgeable than you were at the beginning of the week. And that's a big part of this podcast because it is a celebration of all the things that we can learn together and learn throughout our lives and careers about this field. And I hope you embrace that. And now a word from our sponsor. This podcast was sponsored by Periscope Data. So Periscope Data was specifically designed for data teams. Basically, they turn complicated data requests, like SQL queries, into awesome analyses you can share with your whole company, embed into web pages, share with a link, share with email, all in seconds. It does a bunch of handy SQL stuff, like auto-formatting, auto-complete, snippets, SQL views, for you hardcore SQL folks, and it's backed by Redshift, so it's super fast. Another database that you might want to learn. Now, the swag part. Just visit periscopedata.com/PD to sign up for a free trial and receive one of their world-famous mugs with enough coffee to get you running as fast as they do. So go get one. That's periscopedata.com/PD. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the show for this week. I hope you found it entertaining. And if you found it educational, well, that's sort of a bonus. That's not really my goal, but that's, you know, I hope you do. As always, you can reach us on Twitter at @PartiallyD, and you can reach me on Twitter at @ChrisAlbin. Have a great week, all.